Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
On Point is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston. The program is made possible by your financial support. Please pledge online at WBUR.org.
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Anthony Cordesman and Michael O'Hanlon, two big war analysts, returned late last month from a whirlwind 8-day tour of Iraq, courtesy of the U.S. military. Their verdict? Hang in there. O'Hanlon asserts this is a war we might just win, and Cordesman says let's be patient. But they're in a dwindling camp. A recent poll shows only about a third of Americans think the war in Iraq is going well. So what's it going to be? This hour, On Point, we'll hear from two big Iraq war watchers counseling patience in Iraq and from a critic who says they've got it wrong. Joining me today from Washington is Michael O'Hanlon, senior fellow in foreign policy studies at the Brookings Institution. He returned July 25th from Iraq and is co-author with Kenneth Pollack of the July 30th op-ed piece in the New York Times, Stability in Iraq, A War We Just Might Win. Michael O'Hanlon, thanks very much for being here.
Nice to be here, Tom.
And with us from Washington, Anthony Cordesman, chair in strategy at the Center for Strategic and International Studies. He was on the same July 17 to 25th trip to Iraq, and last week published his report titled The Tenuous Case for Strategic Patience in Iraq. Anthony Cordesman, welcome back. Thanks for joining us.
Hello.
All right. Let's jump into the we'll go to your analysis, and we very much want to hear it, but we've got to deal with the context for just a second first. I mean, you've come back, Michael O'Hanlon, you and Kenneth Pollack, put an op-ed piece out there right away, and man, did it hit the wasp nest. Anthony Cordesman says in his report, that over these years of war, all the half-truths and spin of the past have built up a valid distrust of virtually anything the administration says about Iraq. Help us understand the context, the envelope of your trip first. It was entirely organized or overwhelmingly organized by the U.S. military. How should we then see it? Is this a dog and pony show, as Senator James Webb has called this kind of trip? Or as a serious war analyst, do you think you can really see what's going on in that kind of company when the military is your host and guide?
Tom, I think that you can do a pretty good job of understanding what's going on when you have 8 days opportunity to probe and push and inquire, and when you are also in the company of two of our nation's best Iraq experts, Tony Cordesman and Ken Pollack, as I was fortunate enough to be, and when you have longstanding relationships with a number of these generals who in the past have often been very forthright, especially in private conversations of the type we had in Iraq, when they did not think things were going well. And also, all of us follow Iraq fairly carefully. And myself, I've done the Iraq Index at Brookings for 4 years. Mm-hmm. Tony and Ken have an even more longstanding expertise in the field. And you have certain questions on your mind, things you're trying to get answers to, and areas where you can push for information. And we did not come back, by the way, and say that everything was hunky-dory. There are a lot of areas where, mm-hmm. where and the title, by the way, was also not our choice. I would not use the word victory or win to describe what I think are plausible goals. We're looking for a sustainable stability, as we explicitly argued in the second paragraph of our op-ed. But in any event, the point is we did not take every bit of good news or optimism, nor was the military trying to spin everything as positive. There was an opportunity to do a lot of probing and a lot of pushing. There are limits to this, and my last word right now will be that we didn't get a great feel, of course, for the Iraqi street. We did not spend a lot of time on that street, and that street is still a very violent place, and I wouldn't pretend otherwise for a second. But I think there is military momentum on the battlefield for the first time in years.
Let me clarify one other point, then. You and Ken Pollack describe yourselves in the Times op-ed piece as war critics. Of course, he is author of the 2002 book, The Threatening Storm, The Case for Invading Iraq. And while we have heard, certainly, criticism from you over the years, at many points you have also offered encouragement to hang in there. This is not the first time. In what sense exactly are you a war critic?
Well, let's be a little careful here. I think what Ken and I said, and I think we should be allowed to define our own words, especially if that's what you're saying. What we said is we have been harsh critics of the Bush administration's miserable handling of the war. That was the expression we used in our op-ed. The bloggers have often called us war critics and then tried to say that somehow we were setting ourselves out as comprehensively and systematically against this war. You are right. We have not done so. We have been in the Shinseki school that said if you're going to go in big, go in strong with a serious plan, sort of the Shinseki Zinni plan approach, as opposed to being adamantly opposed to the invasion in the first place, which we were not. So I'll be very clear about that in a way that some of our critics, frankly, have not been as clear.
Anthony Cordesman, begin to take us into your analysis, and perhaps we could go in this way. I heard Senator John McCain saying this morning on NPR in the morning news, we are winning in Iraq. Do you agree? Is that a fact?
The problem with almost all of these bottom lines is unless you define your terms, you can give a firm yes or no. It's important to note that we have achieved some gains that we didn't expect, largely because there was a tribal uprising in Anbar against the excesses of Al-Qaeda. That has given us a level of security and an ability to deal with Al-Qaeda that we had no way of anticipating with the strategy we had or that the president announced in January. It has compensated for what in many areas has been the weakness of the Iraqi police, the national police, on a military level. But the security gains so far have not been matched by any political gains that really change the facts on the ground. There have not been the kind of economic progress and security that would help. We did see, I think, significant steps forward in areas like Anbar and to the north. There is some progress in Baghdad, but that progress in Baghdad is very uncertain. We've not been able to put an end to sectarian cleansing. There are indications that in being able to deal with Al-Qaeda, we have created at least a partial vacuum that's been exploited by the Sadr militia and other elements to push Sunnis out of the city. And when we talk about the south of Iraq, we found that our provincial reconstruction teams were basically not able to go into two of the most important provinces, with the two key shrine cities of Karbala and Najaf, and we did not go to southeastern Iraq, where, to all intents and purposes, the British have been decisively defeated. They really have three tiny enclaves in the area around Basra. They've effectively retreated to the airport. The whole southeast, four provinces, are now the scene of struggles between three rival Shiite groups, all of which have Iranian backing. So when you talk about winning, we are not winning. We do have, as Mike has suggested, the opportunity to move forward. But as General Petraeus, as Ambassador Crocker, and indeed all of the Iraqi officials we talked to have said, if there is not major Iraqi political progress toward conciliation, not only are we not winning, frankly, we can't win.
All right, then, Michael O'Hanlon, in that case, I mean, you pushed for the surge. Everybody said from the beginning that the strategy was to open up space for political evolution, for political development in Iraq. Now you've gone out for 8 days, come back and said we're making progress on the military front. But if that political progress is not there, does it matter? Does it matter if we've made a beachhead here and a beachhead there? You were in Ramadi and Baghdad and Mosul and Tal Afar. Does it matter if we make incremental military progress if the political, you know, picture, the big context, is not there for this country to flow more stably into?
I agree with Tony. Over the long term, we can't be successful unless we have major political progress, both from the bottom up and from the top down. So there is some reconciliation happening here and there at the local level. That's helpful. That's important. But in the end, we're going to have to see substantially more dramatic steps to be successful. But Tom, the question right now, and I think for the Congress in the next few weeks, is going to be, given where we are, with substantial military progress, although still a very long ways to go, obviously, in stabilizing Iraq, and with very minimal political progress, and the only real progress of any type being at the local level, not the national level, do you keep trying a while longer? What's your theory for how long is long enough before you abandon the effort? That's a question that I think people can disagree on, even if they accept a fairly common factual basis. And our op-ed did give our opinion at the end that we thought, Ken and I thought, the surge should continue into 2008. But the main point of our argument was to make sure people were aware of positive battlefield dynamics that by themselves are certainly not sufficient, to get back to your question, for ultimate success, but do give some kind of sense that things are headed in the right direction. I would like to see us try a while longer to hope that the military progress can spill over into the political realm. But I certainly cannot give you a convincing theory as to why that's likely to happen or sure to happen. I'm just hoping that it might.
Anthony Cordesman, if it's all about hope, if there's no convincing theory available as to why political development may follow some military successes, should the American people hang in there with this?
I think the problem we face is when you pose it in very simple terms, it's very hard to reach an intelligent conclusion. We face a reality where I think Iraqi and U.S. time coincide. If this central government cannot achieve real progress toward conciliation no later than the late winter or early spring of 2008, I frankly do not see it as being able to survive. The country hasn't partitioned softly. It's been brutal. We have a great deal of responsibility for that. And one of the things that's easy to ignore is American actions have taken a country under a truly evil dictator and produced 2 million exiles, displaced 2 million other Iraqis, according to one recent study, reduced 8 million to dire poverty. We have at least 100,000 Iraqi dead and several hundred thousand Iraqi casualties, and most of that is a result of our actions. Now, should we hang in there? We have to remember our moral and ethical responsibility here.
Anthony Cordesman, Michael O'Hanlon, please stand by. We're talking with two big war analysts counseling patience in Iraq. We'll be right back. Anthony Cordesman, you mentioned the luck that the U.S. has had in Sunnis turning against al-Qaeda. President Bush has recently characterized the war in Iraq as a battle, you know, with al-Qaeda, the same guys that brought us 9/11, and yet I think I see in your piece a statistic that maybe only 15% of the forces arrayed against the U.S. there are now al-Qaeda.
Well, it's actually 15% of the incidents. Nobody has the slightest idea of how many insurgents there are, particularly because it's so hard to define. It's also quite clear that part of the problem we face is the Shiite militias, and indeed, after we came back, it turned out that they were responsible for more American casualties in recent weeks than the Sunni groups. But this is, I think, the reason to try to find some way of bringing conciliation to these groups. We're talking about whatever the numbers are of either Sunni Islamists or Shiite extremists, tiny minorities, according to Iraqi public opinion polls, according to our intelligence estimates, thousands of people in a country with nearly 28 million people. The fact is, if we can find a way of pushing the Iraqi government into conciliation, if we can build up the provinces, build up local governments, as Mike pointed out, where there is progress, if we can find ways to recast our aid program to provide incentives that will really bring these people together and build on limited military success, there is the possibility of moving forward. If we don't do that, the problem is not simply one of convenience to the United States. It really is the future of Iraq, of its people, our position in the region, and the risk that this is going to spill over far beyond the borders of Iraq. This is not just about us.
But if it's just 15% of the incidents that can be related to the sort of al-Qaeda, Salafist elements in Iraq, doesn't that give credence to the view that this is a civil war? This is largely Shiite. And where we've seen the British pull out in the south, we've seen Shiite-on-Shiite violence increase.
Well, Secretary Gates has made it quite clear that we're talking about four overlapping civil conflicts. Incidentally, you used the phrase neo-Salafi. We can't even count the number of neo-Salafi movements. But al-Qaeda is only one neo-Salafi movement.
And sort of fundamentalist Islamist movement, yes.
Now, a lot of them now have evidently turned against al-Qaeda and are working with U.S. forces. It's an uncertain structure. But also, it's important to understand that out of those 15% of incidents, the bloodiest suicide bombings, the large car bombings, the constant attacks on civilians, the ones designed to provoke brutal, ongoing civil conflict have been largely dominated by al-Qaeda. And if you can both destroy al-Qaeda's ability to operate and limit sectarian cleansing by the Shiite militias, there is at least a window for political conciliation and working out some kind of stable structure inside the country.
Michael O'Hanlon, you make the case that political progress has been essentially nil at the top. I think it could be argued there's even been, a retreat. I mean, we've got all kinds of people dropping out of the government in recent weeks. But you make the case that somehow a new stability can be built up from the local level with American support. Describe, fill out that case for us. It's hard to picture how in the midst of all this you can build up from the individual atoms of villages and towns and cities a stable whole if you don't have an overarching government that works, that has unity of some kind.
Well, I'll start with a basic reality in Iraq today, which is finally some of the money that the government in Baghdad is supposed to give to the provinces is starting to flow to them, which means they are now increasingly able to do some of the economic development projects or the hiring of security forces and equipping of those forces that they would have wanted to all along. Now, there's a lot of interference. There is still a lot of Shia in the central government who don't want to see Sunnis helped, for example, and certainly don't want to see them brought into the security forces. There are a lot of other problems at the local level, but there are places, for example, up north in Nineveh province where we visited Tal Afar and Mosul, where there is an ethnic mix that's a little less incendiary, perhaps, still very complex and dangerous, but where there's a little bit less of a legacy of huge-scale Shia-Sunni brutality, and perhaps a little bit more progress in building a way forward. And I think that some of what you're seeing now with the flow of these funds is the opportunity for that to begin. I'm not convinced it's going to succeed. Tony and Ken have heard me make the pitch for soft partition into three regions, which I acknowledge is very hard to do and which the Iraqis on the whole don't favor themselves now, and which would require huge movements of populations and recreation of new regional government capacity. So it's not an easy panacea by any means. But that's a backup plan in my mind. What's going on now is that we are seeing efforts to get these provincial governments more effective, more empowered, more resourced, and there's a chance that some of that can lead to progress.
Let's go to Jeremy in Westboro, Massachusetts. Jeremy, you're on the air with Michael O'Hanlon and Anthony Cordesman.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Sure.
I was calling because I just wanted to express as a civilian and a prior vet that I think there should be a little more patience exerted simply because I comfort myself by knowing that there are people making decisions that get way more information than I do, and the only thing I get is what the media distills, and as much as they try to keep it unbiased, I'm sure everybody has their opinions as to what's going on there.
But Jeremy, look at the path we've been down, under the leadership of those people who supposedly had so much more information. WMD, no. Cakewalk, no. War going on for years. I mean, the people in power hardly brought us, what appeared to be promised here.
Oh, true. But also at the same time, when our country was first formed and it went through civil wars and unrest, it's also taken a lot of time for us to get ourselves back on our own feet.
200 and some years? I mean...
I hope we're not over there for that amount of time, but as we can see, it is a longer process, and I have family serving as well, and I just pray every day that they come home safe and sound, and they just do the best job they can when they're there.
And you're ready to vote for patience, and we hear it. Let's go to Greg in Cedar Rapids, Iowa. Greg, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
In my opinion, I think we've already lost this war. When you figure what we're spending, current figures now are saying that this war is going to end up costing us about $2 trillion. We've got supposedly the infrastructure in this country falling apart. We've got the American people being told every day that to be fearful of an attack, and they run around crazy in some respects. The you have people at airports going through crazy searches, and yet our borders are completely open. You have our civil liberties being lost on a day-by-day basis.
And behind it all, the cost you point to there first, Greg, and let us pick that up. Anthony Cordesman, how about it? You and Michael Henlon are not asking at this point for eternal patience. You're both looking to early 08 and saying, let's hang in that long. But on the other hand, the sort of underlying message is, this is not going to be solved quickly. It could last a long, long time. And Greg says, can we afford it?
Well, there are a couple of realities here. When you talk about the burden of American defense expenditure, even with all the costs of Afghanistan and Iraq, we're spending less of our gross national product and our federal budget on defense than we were during the period after the Cold War ended. The problem is not that this is a strain on the American economy or it's crippling our ability to spend on domestic programs. All of the figures make it clear it isn't. We're also talking to date around something on the order of a maximum commitment of $813 billion. That's not small. But if we stay on for another year, we're not talking about vast additional expenditures on the level of $2 trillion. We also have a material reality. Unless you absolutely have to rush people out and abandon equipment, bases, and facilities, you really can't reduce U.S. troops quickly. You have to pull them out in phased levels. The U.S. military says it would take 2 years. Looking at the numbers in reality, it probably would take at least 9 months. But when we talk about patience, the fact is we're going to have to show it anyway.
But is another year really what you're, is another year, your words, really what you're talking about here? Another year? And I mean, it often feels like...
You asked about, Tom,
mm-hmm. Yes.
Please keep your terms straight. You asked about dollars, and then you asked about another year, and I assume you mean troop levels. Now, one of the things that I think was made clear to us when we were in Iraq is that the country team is looking at ways to phase down U.S. forces significantly. It doesn't have magic numbers. It hasn't made those public. I don't know what General Petraeus or Ambassador Crocker is going to say. But the fact is, if we get political conciliation, then we will be able to phase down U.S. troops, cut expenditures, and do so significantly during 2008. If we don't get political conciliation by the end of this winter or next spring, then we have almost no rationale for staying, because there gets to be a point at which you simply cannot wait out the Iraqi political process forever.
Mm. And of course, as you both point out, political conciliation, whatever may be happening militarily, is exactly what has not appeared. Let's go to Mark in Acton, Massachusetts. Mark, you're on the air.
Hello. I wanted to bore in a little bit more on that first question you posed, Tom, and that is the organization of this trip. And I heard, Mr. O'Hanlon, your response, which I thought was somewhat superficial in that I have read the interview that you gave to Glenn Greenwald last week, and I wanted to find out whether this is actually true as to what you folks did. And the question is really directed at both Mr. O'Hanlon and Mr. Cordesman. Mr. Greenwald says, as a result of the interview, that you were there for 7.5 days. You spent every night ensconced in the Green Zone in Baghdad. You didn't spend a single night in any other city. And that you, Mr. O'Hanlon, admitted that you spent no more than between 2 to 4 hours in every place you visited outside Baghdad, much of which was taken up meeting U.S. military commanders, not inspecting the conditions on the ground. And that your, in fact, the point of your op-ed was to stress the fact that this was the focus of the perspective of the U.S. military, and that you essentially relied on the fact that the idea that the military was telling you the truth.
Mm. Mark, let us pick it up. Michael O'Hanlon, Glenn Greenwald, Salon.com calls the whole trip a ludicrous and misleading spectacle. You hear the kind of questions Mark puts forward. What do you say?
Well, I don't have high regard for the kind of journalism that Mr. Greenwald has carried out here. I think that he's missing the point, which is that what's going on the ground is fairly striking. And I think there's a much more serious criticism of my position, frankly, which is that what you've been sort of intimating at, Tom, the Iraqi political progress is not there. And how much longer can we keep making military efforts and sacrificing the lives and well-being of our men and women in arms if we're not seeing the Iraqis do their part? And moreover, the opportunity cost, even though Tony's right about the budgetary cost being finite, the opportunity cost of how we define our role in the world is actually very high, because we are not able to project other major efforts in the war on terror of perhaps a more conciliatory or soft power nature, since the whole world sees us in Iraq as the preeminent foreign policy activity of the United States. To me, that's the serious critique. I'm not going to spend a whole lot of time rebutting Mr. Greenwald, because he's had, frankly, more time and more readership than he deserves. I worked very hard, along with my colleagues, to get information about what's going on the ground, and I don't think I overstated the case. For example, a one-third reduction in civilian fatalities, even though that means that Iraq is still extremely brutal, easily the most violent country in the Middle East, and still a country at war. I don't think I sugarcoated. I don't think I went out of my way to tell a story that was based on a dog and pony show. The military progress is real. Critics should focus on why the opportunity costs of continuing are still too high nonetheless, rather than worrying about my motives as if somehow, you know, I gained some huge benefit. I've made a lot more political enemies in my own party, the Democratic Party, than I've gained in any other way by virtue of this trip. So I'm a little upset by it, but I just think it's a waste of time that our debate should focus on whether this trip was the ultimate fact-finding mission. Of course, there are facts that we did not claim to report about: the state of the Iraqi street, the state of the Iraqi economy. Those are in our Iraq Index at Brookings, and for 4 years I've been showing that there has not been a lot of progress in those areas, and I've been very clear about that. So I don't think I'm a very interesting story here. What's interesting are the facts on the ground in Iraq, and they are relatively promising on the battlefront. They are not at all promising in the political sphere. They are not very noteworthy at all in the economic sphere. Draw your own conclusions. Let's have a policy debate. That's the interesting conversation.
Mm. Anthony Cordesman, we've just got you for a couple more minutes. Michael O'Hanlon will stick around. But talk to us about the timeline then. I want to be clear, I understand. You're saying there's a tenuous case here for strategic patience, and for Americans listening right now, just how much more after all the patience that the country has shown already?
Well, the country's patience, let me note, involved breaking a country called Iraq. And the idea that somehow we have shown patience and Iraq has been responsible for the consequences of our invasion strikes me as morally and ethically ridiculous. But in terms of the timeline, my own feeling is that Iraq's central government is not going to hold together unless it really moves forward in the key elements of conciliation. Sharing the oil wealth, that's both money and resources. Creating a way of devolving power down into the provinces. Dealing with the reality of the divisions inside Iraq. Bringing the Sunnis back into the central government and in the military. Finding ways to deal with economic construction that can develop the country and provide an incentive for unity. Dealing with the problems left over from the Constitution. All of these issues are in draft legislation. All of them are issues that the government can act on if it chooses to act on them by late this winter or early this spring. If it doesn't, then the case for strategic patience ends at that point in time.
Anthony Cordesman at the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you.
Michael O'Hanlon, please stand by in a moment. We'll be joined by James Fearon at Stanford University with a different view. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. We're talking about patience and Iraq. We're coming up on September when General David Petraeus and Ambassador Ryan Crocker are supposed to talk to the President and the Congress about what's going on there. Michael O'Hanlon is back just at the end of July from 7.5, 8 days in Iraq. He says there's enough reason to hang in, at least until early 08 here. We're joined now from Stanford, California, by James Fearon, professor of political science at Stanford University. Last September, he testified before Congress on what was going on in Iraq. His recent article on Iraq, titled Iraq's Civil War, was in the March-April edition of Foreign Affairs. James Fearon, thank you very much for joining us today.
Hi, Tom.
The American people have some tough decisions here to make, as does the Congress and the government. Anthony Cordesman, and I think you heard him, said, you know, let's not simplify too much. And yet, at a certain point, there's simple decisions that have to be made. Michael O'Hanlon and Anthony Cordesman have come back and said, be patient. Should we?
Well, I guess I'm puzzled as to as to the position that we've heard Michael and Anthony Cordesman lay out. In some ways, I guess in certain basic ways, I agree with many of their assessments of the facts on the ground and where we are militarily, although I might have some differences. But what I'm baffled by are the conclusions they draw from this. Michael said earlier that, you know, the hope for, or, you know, for staying the course a bit longer was that military progress might lead to political progress. But I think I heard him correctly to say, I think I'm quoting, that he has no convincing theory as to why that might happen. Anthony Cordesman's, the title of his report is The Tenuous Case for Strategic Patience in Iraq. And if you read it, I think it's that's an apt title. It's a highly tenuous case. I can't understand how, when so much is at stake, you know, Americans being killed every day, billions of dollars, huge costs in terms of our strategic position, that you'd want to make policy on the basis of basically hopes that you admit have, you know, no, you have no convincing theory as to how they're going to pan out.
Let me ask you then. Let me ask you about two kind of vectors that run through each of them. You heard Anthony Cordesman saying strongly there. Essentially, there are some signs of hope, and we have a moral and ethical obligation to stay. And Michael O'Hanlon, if I can look for bottom lines here, saying there's local stabilization, that if we continue to nurture that, that could add up to a kind of political stabilization, you know, sort of locale by locale. What about each of those arguments?
Well, let's take the question about, you know, the hope in all this from, you know, William Crystal and Fred Kagan and all, is the idea has been if we increase, we get better security, somehow this will enable political reconciliation. And basically what the fundamental object of the administration's policy has been, which is to put in place a power-sharing deal among the many groups in Iraq that can survive our departure and lead to, you know, a government that can sustain itself, defend itself, and so on. Suppose, you know, let's just grant, suppose that this very unlikely thing actually does start to happen. We see some political reconciliation. Is that actually going to lead the same analyst to say, oh, well, now we can leave? No way. The argument, if that happens, which is not, you know, at all a very likely thing, the argument will be, well, we can't leave now, because if we start to leave, the whole thing will come apart, and that will be correct. So really, I think if you're going to be honest about counseling for, you know, strategic patience, you know, the latest euphemism, or, you know, essentially the stay the course arguments, to be honest, you've got to say what you're really arguing for is a very long-term presence where the U.S. has a quite large presence that's taking fire for very many years, backing up a government in a role that's something like that of a colonial power, standing back or you know, basically providing security, keeping groups from fighting for power who would fight for power if we left. So it seems to me that to be honest about this kind of argument, you've got to say that, well, that's really in our national interest to have, you know, a 10, 15-plus year presence in Iraq, maybe even longer. That's, I think, really where this argument goes.
Michael O'Hanlon, how do you respond? You're pretty grim on the political progress. It's laid out very clearly in your report. It's not there, and yet James Fearon, and I think I as well hear you saying that is essential, ultimately. If it's not appearing, what gives you a hope against hope that it will? And does it, either way, does it put us, the U.S., as James Fearon says, in the position of being a kind of colonial power for a decade or more?
A couple of things. James has made some very good points, although I would point out that I'm hardly the only person, or this position is hardly the only one that has uncertainty associated with it. There's huge uncertainties associated with what will happen to the region if and when we pack up and go home. And I think, again, in the spirit of being honest, it's important to acknowledge that. Now, you could argue it's going to be a risk worth running, but it is a huge risk. So there are no safe, predictable courses of action here. That's one thing I would say. A second point is there is some progress at the the local level in terms of stabilization, in terms of political reconciliation. But I am not going to give you a happy story about the overall trend line here. It is not good. James and I clearly agree on that. The question is, when do you conclude that our efforts have failed? Partly because I don't see great alternatives, and because I am very fearful of the idea of the United States and its friends in Iraq being defeated by forces of anarchy and jihadism, I think we should try to see if we can get the momentum to spread to the political theater. What is the probability? I don't know. There are a number of very good leaders in Iraq who do want it to happen. There are a number of others who are very, very sectarian in their thinking. My guess is we may need to see the Maliki government make one last push and perhaps fall in the next month or two and see maybe one last try at a new government for a few months. I don't know what the theory is exactly. James is right. I don't have a theory that makes me confident it will work, but I also think there are a number of scenarios you could spell out where we would have some progress. And the stakes here are so high, and the military momentum is so recent that I personally, at a gut level, would prefer to try it a while longer. It's not a sophisticated theory. I don't claim any ability to establish a clear causality path here, but I think we should try to build on the momentum and hope. And that's I know it's a funny word to end with, but I admit this is a theory of hope more than a proof.
James Fearon, how about it then? If none of the options are pretty, and Michael O'Hanlon concedes that there's a baseline of just raw, desperate hope in his message here, if the alternate is to concede we have failed and begin doing something else, what's the scenario that brings toward us, to your mind?
Well, I guess 2 points. One, I just don't think hope without any, you know, kind of rational basis is, you know, it just can't be the way to make policy on such an important matter.
What's the alternate picture or path then?
Yeah. So on that, as Anthony Cordesman pointed out, you know, withdrawing, it's not like, and I certainly am not saying, well, we should just exit tomorrow. That's not a feasible or realistic option anyway. Unless we were going to leave massive amounts of stuff there, and you know, at enormous cost, you know, a kind of a reasonable withdrawal is going to take at least a year, possibly longer. So it seems to me that if you don't have kind of a plausible endpoint in terms of how you're going to get to the end that the administration and it sounds like Anthony Cordesman and Michael O'Hanlon would like to get to. You have to bite the bullet. The responsible, I mean, it's going to take a lot of political courage. One reason why I think it's, you know, I'd like to see someone start sooner rather than later is to start to move towards the exit. You know, to start withdrawing troops. I'm encouraged to hear that our military is making plans for this. That's good. I think that the actual process, I mean, you know, how we do it, the specifics, where our troops go, it's going to be a fluid situation and where we're going to have to make a lot of decisions kind of tactically, strategically, politically, militarily on the ground as we go along. But, you know, I guess the fundamental point is if there really is no scenario whereby we can stuff we do in the next year by staying longer or 2 years or for that matter is going to leave us with a government that we can leave without things falling apart again. I think you have to say it's really going to be on the Iraqis to build political order in their country. It's not something we can do effectively with our military forces while we're there, unless maybe and only maybe if we stay for a very, very long time. And this is just not in our interest. So I don't know. That's what I'd say.
Let's go to Nashville and Jonathan. Jonathan, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for having me.
Yeah.
I guess my comments regarding patience and long term. One of the panelists had said, you know, we're in it for the long term. Is this question about how long were we in Germany, Japan, and Korea, or more to the point, we're still there?
Many decades. James Fearon, what about it? The Germany, Japan timetable comparison.
Well, it's an interesting comparison. It's a, you know, we were able to get to in Germany, Japan, and Japan a situation. You know, fairly quickly, although it was rough at first, fairly quickly where, you know, no one was shooting at us.
and you had rapidly rebuilding economies in the German case, you know, in a advanced industrial part of the world. That's not going to happen in Iraq. We're, as long as we're there, there are going to be jihadists coming from all over the Middle East to try to get us out. It's going to be a huge mobilizing force, for many, many years. A lot of the people trying to get us out will be Iraqi nationalists, as long as we're there. So it's going to be a very different thing.
Let's go to Paul in Nashua, New Hampshire. Paul, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking the call.
Certainly.
I was a little bit sad to see Cordesman leave, but in any case, I wanted to ask the panelists, and some of this stuff has already been addressed, but what makes anybody think that the central government, their objectives and ours are coextensive? I mean, I don't understand it. They've been kicking this can down the road in terms of reconciliation for quite a while. I really wanted to get their professional opinion on that.
That's a great question. Michael O'Hanlon, how about it? Of course, Prime Minister Maliki has been in Iran recently, you know, smiling, beaming with Ahmadinejad. President Bush said he doesn't much like that. Plenty of people on the record saying they're not even sure where Maliki's loyalties ultimately lie, if he's really a unifier or sectarian at heart. And you hear our caller, Paul, he's not sure either. How do you see the Maliki government at bottom?
Not very favorably. I think that Mr. al-Maliki is not, I don't believe he's dominated by the desire for revenge. I don't believe he's a ruthless killer, but I think he has, unfortunately, two attributes that are not very promising here. And by the way, we did not get a chance to meet with him, although we did meet with President Talabani and a number of other Iraqi leaders. But one is he's seen as relatively weak and indecisive. And secondly, he's a bit paranoid about Sunnis. He tends to think, and this is reported by a number of people who do know him, he tends to worry that a Ba'athist resurgence is never far behind, and when you empower Sunnis and police forces or other institutions, there's a high chance that they will be seeing this as a way to ultimately mount a coup attempt against him and more generally against the Shia. I would much prefer, certainly, to see someone like Ayad Alawi as the Iraqi leader, and I wish that were already the case. And by the way, the sectarian paranoias are deep enough that I still prefer, in my own advocacy, to consider the idea of a soft partitioning of Iraq into three autonomous regions. I still think that would probably help mitigate some of these paranoias more effectively. But I pushed that when I was in Iraq, but it's probably not going to happen anytime soon. Now, there still is some hope that you will get stronger leaders rather than al-Maliki. And let me say one encouraging and positive thing about the Shia as I wrap up on this point. Mm. They spent decades tolerating Ba'athist oppression. Then they spent 2.5 years tolerating a former Ba'athist and Sunni insurgency and terrorism. And it wasn't until the February 2006 bombing of the Golden Mosque in Samarra that they really engaged in the reprisal attacks that have unfortunately now come to dominate Iraq in the way that Professor Fearon has written so elegantly. And I'm hopeful, therefore, that there are enough positive forces among the Shia that there's a chance to put this back together. It obviously would have been much better to do the right thing 4 years ago and after we invaded to do the Shinseki-Zinni approach towards a very muscular restoration of stability. The Bush administration, I think, will always be harshly criticized in history for not having done that, and it makes our job a lot harder. But there's still at least some Shia elements of constructive thinking.
James Fearon, I want to get you on that as well, but let me get one more call first from Joe in Des Moines, Iowa. Joe, you're on the air.
Hello, gentlemen.
Hi.
Remember these words, if you break it, you own it. And while I was totally against going in the beginning, we're there. We own it. We have a moral. We have to stay and fix it. And we cannot leave or we're going to be running away the rest of our, in my lifetime and in my children's lifetime. We need to turn the power on. We need to get the water flowing. One of these things, you know, everybody's talking about, oh, running away. You cannot run away from what we've done. We're there. We need to make sure the world knows that regardless of the cost, that we will stick this out and make it right. Now, once we get, you know, once they get their army in place and they have a central government, you know, it's no different. What would have happened if we would have left Korea? What would have happened if we would have left some of the other places?
Joe, our time is short. Let me give it to James Fearon. Professor Fearon, of course, Colin Powell said it as a warning. Now maybe it's, I don't know, a ball and chain, but you break it, you own it. Joe says, we must stay. How do you respond as a scholar of civil war to that?
I think you have to ask yourself. It's really not plausible that you're going to be able to fix it, as the caller says, in the sense that we've been laying out, unless we stay 20 plus years, maybe, you know, who knows, but a very, very long time at tremendous cost. And even then, it's not sure. You know, does it really make sense to take on an essentially kind of colonial role in Iraq? At what point does it really become a matter where you got to say, you know, yes, we went in, we tried to do the right thing by bringing about a better government or helping the Iraqis get a better government than they had with Saddam Hussein. But at the end of the day, it's their country, and it's something that they've got to work out amongst themselves. I guess that's what I'd say.
Michael O'Hanlon, my old friend Tom Ricks, of course, often says that he looks out at kids on American playgrounds today and imagines that those toddlers will one day still be fighting in Iraq. Is that what you see? Is that the kind of patience you're prescribing?
I think the plausible path, if the surge does well enough to finally get some Iraqi political support, the plausible path is we're down, let's say, into the range of 120,000 U.S. forces by this time next year, maybe crossing below the 100,000 level early in the next president's term, probably staying in Iraq with at least a few tens of thousands of forces throughout that next president's term if we're going to continue this kind of strategy.
And maybe, as James Ferrand says, much, much longer. Michael O'Hanlon, thank you for your time today. Thank you for your report.
Thank you.
Michael O'Hanlon at the Brookings Institution and James Ferron, Professor of Political Science at Stanford University. Professor Ferron, thanks very much for joining us again.
Thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.